Pleased to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we begin our program by talking with you about the International Year of Astronomy. Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, one of our guests, the other Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton, our other guest, and they've been with us a lot of times to talk about astronomy, to talk about optics. Certainly, if you have questions in either of those areas, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us, and that address is talk@WPR.org. Jim Lattice, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
And Tom Hall, good to see you again, too.
Good morning, Larry.
What is the, let's talk first, briefly before we take calls here, what's the International Year of Astronomy? You know, why do we have it and so forth?
Right. Well, the it's in a series. The UN, I think, does these international years of this or that all the time. And 2009, they settled on 2009 because 2009 is the 400th anniversary of a couple of very important astronomical events that happened in the history of astronomy. In 1609 was when Galileo first turned his telescope on the sky and discovered a bunch of fascinating things that we can talk about. And that's also when Johann Kepler published his book in which he described the two laws of planetary motion that all of gravitational theory and astronomy in the solar system anyway have been based on ever since then. Well, really well outside the solar system too. So those two events are the sort of the anniversary, kind of the excuse in a way of then having a year-long celebration of astronomy when we hope to get people out to look at the sky and look through telescopes and read about astronomy. And there's all kinds of material that's been developed on the web and for activities that we want to do locally as well here at Space Place and in Wisconsin.
So lots of activities going on, and I have some really cool ones that we can talk about. One that intrigues me is the Galileo scope. That's kind of a Wisconsin product in some ways, isn't it?
It really is. As I said, one of the goals of the International Year of Astronomy is to get people to look through a telescope, and so it follows from that you have to get people either to a telescope or get a telescope to them. And the Galileo scope is the attempt to do that second part, to get telescopes to people. They designed, the goal was to design something roughly like Galileo's telescope, but a 21st century version of it. So it's a refracting telescope with really good optics. And they hope to produce, well, originally they wanted to produce about 1 million of them to go out around the world at a really, really low price that might be in bulk about $10 a piece, which is an amazingly low price for a good telescope. It's astounding. Yeah. And it has important local connections. Doug Arion, who's on the faculty at Carthage College, is one of the designers of the Galileo scope. And they have manufacturing partners. The project does in Racine, Merritt Models. Tom Smith there at Merritt Models is an avid astronomer and is involved in the project. And so all the Galileo scopes that get produced will come through Racine on their way out to the world.
To wherever they go. Tom Hall, have you had a chance to look at a prototype of this?
It's an interesting little kit. You know, it's just about, 14 or so, 15 inches long.
It's about right.
And it is a true kit. You put the lenses in what is essentially a prepackaged plastic shell that snaps together. You don't need glue or assembly parts. It goes
tools
together. It's just a terrific little design, and anyone could put them together. And really, really nice optics by the time you look through them. It should be a hopefully great little partnership that gets off the ground.
I'm going to buy one.
Well, maybe, can I toss out the website?
Yes.
You can. There's a website. It's easy. Galileo Scope, all one word, galileoscope.org. And they will eventually be taking orders, they think this week. They're supposed to start taking orders. Now, I have to say, though, that the original plan is to take orders of lots of 100. So we'll see. I don't know whether they're going to market individual scopes right away. But if you want to buy 100 of them for your community.
or your school or whatever.
Yeah, or just find out more about them, then galileoscope.org is the website to go to.
Well, it sounds like a great idea, and it probably we're not individual copies are probably going to cost a little more, $12-15, but still,
yeah, Right. That's right. But but still, yeah, I mean, this is a telescope. I don't know. You probably couldn't get a comparable, optically speaking, telescope for, I don't know, several times that price.
Oh, several times that. $50, $60
Yeah.
And they mount to any tripod. You know, they don't come with the tripod, but they have the mounts
built
in there.
That's right. Mount to a standard photo tripod, yeah.
Easy to replace if things get stripped out or broken. Or it looks like a real nice, workable little model.
It's also designed to experiment with. So, for example, an eyepiece comes with it, but it's a standard size eyepiece. So you could put in other telescope eyepieces. You can put in a Barlow lens. One of the fun things is you can turn it into an actual Galilean telescope, meaning that has a specific optical meaning, by putting in a fairly standard accessory called a Barlow lens in place of its eyepiece. And then you see what Galileo saw, which is not as good as what you see with modern telescopes. It's an interesting comparison.
Well, caller's online, so Edie in Baraboo, we'll go to you first. Edie, hi.
Hi. This morning when I was out doing chores, feeding my animals, the sun had almost looked like it had a rainbow around it. Mm. And it was long, white light streaks. And is that what they call sun dogs?
Could you, what direction were the streaks going?
They were on both sides of it, it would be east and west. No, north and south.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so parallel to the horizon, but left and right of the sun?
Yeah,
that sounds like sun dogs.
And they were kind of circling the sun, but they were quite a ways away.
So you sort of saw a halo around the sun with bright spots in it?
No, it was more like if you'd taken a brush and just kind of went whoosh, around both sides, like a comma almost.
Yeah.
And not it was lower than half of the sun. You know, it was lower than the sun.
You mean closer to the horizon than the sun? Oh, interesting. I don't know a specific word for that kind of thing, but we do get a lot of, this is obviously perfect conditions for atmospheric ice crystals, and that's typically what causes that kind of thing. And the distribution, the local distribution of the ice crystals will change what you see. With a uniform distribution, what you typically get are, Tom's telling me, 30 degrees away from the sun. Or is that 30 degrees from side to side?
30 degrees away from the sun.
Okay, 30 degrees away from the sun, you'll see bright spots that are called sun dogs or false suns or parhelia, they're sometimes called. But if you saw something lower than the sun, I'm not sure what that was, but probably another aspect of ice crystal distribution there.
Ice crystal sounds like,
does
makes sense to me.
Does that mean that the weather's going to change? My mother always talks about sun dogs.
Well,
I don't know about that. We need a meteorologist.
I hope. That would be nice.
That would be nice. Yeah. Edie, you've got to listen to the last Monday of the month and call back and ask that question again of our weather guys.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That sounds like a good plan. Thank you very much for calling, though. It's an interesting observation. Maybe others saw it as well. Stephen, Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Larry and guests. I have a question. I think it's related to astronomy. It has to do with the time of the sunrise and the sunset around the winter solstice. According to my Wisconsin Nature calendar, you had the author of that, Dennis Prusik, on a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
The latest sunrise occurs a week after the winter solstice, and the earliest sunset occurs about a week before the winter solstice. So I'm just curious. I would expect both of those to coincide with the winter solstice, but they don't. So I'm wondering why.
Well, that's an excellent question. And the answer is that if you kept time with a sundial instead of a clock, you would find that sunrise and sunset, those extremes do coincide with the solstices. The problem is that clocks run at sort of an average speed throughout the year. But the sun, and that's, of course, those times that you're referring to, the clock time of sunrise or sunset. But there's a fictional thing called the mean sun, which is basically the average sun. And that's what the kitchen clock tracks. The real sun runs faster and slower during the course of the year. And so the actual time of the sunset the earliest sunset, for example, or the latest sunrise, will vary a little bit by, like you say, about a week ahead or behind the solstice. And this is kind of hard to explain verbally, because what you really need is kind of a diagram. But you may have seen, they used to put them on globes all the time, sort of a figure eight kind of thing.
Sure.
That's called the analemma, or it's a representation of something called the equation of time. And the equation of time is the difference between sun time and clock time, what we call mean or normal kitchen clock time. And it's that deviation that causes the offset in the sunrise-sunset times from the solstice itself.
Would it vary with location on the planet or not?
Yes. You mean how the discrepancy between the solstice and the... Yes, yeah, it'll vary with latitude.
All right.
All right, good. Well, I've been wondering about that for a long time.
Yeah, it's not that the solstice isn't the moment. It's just that we don't keep time by the sun, and the sun is what you're talking about.
Sure.
There.
And, so. And it turns out that, you know, if you look at the time of the sunrise and the sunset, it still is the shortest day.
That's exactly right. If you actually started a stopwatch when the sun rises and click it when the sun sets, you'd find the solstice is the shortest period of daylight. That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks
yep.
very much for calling, although it doesn't seem that way. You know, it seems like, you know,
because we notice sunset, we're not as aware of sunrise as we are of sunset. And so the earliest sunset comes before the solstice. And so it seems like it's darker.
Then
it starts getting light after that. So our perception of it, at least most of us, you know,
most of us follow a
normal working sort of schedule. That's, that asymmetry gets us there, too.
We have something coming up called Planet Trek Dane County, and even though it's just Dane County, but people could come from anywhere to see it, and I think
sure.
it's a really interesting thing.
Right. It's this is one of my favorite International Year of Astronomy projects, and as far as I know, it's unique to us. I've been looking a lot at what other people are doing for International Year of Astronomy. We plan to establish a scale model of the solar system. You know, if you see pictures of the solar system and you see there's the sun and there's the planets stretched out there, and they all fit on the page of the book that you're you're looking at, right? And the sun is whatever size it is, and the planets, they always have to exaggerate the sizes of the planets enormously. You'd find if you tried to put out a scale model of the solar system, where you scaled the sizes and the distances down, say in a school gymnasium or something like that, let's say you put Pluto at one end and the sun at the other, Pluto would be microscopic. You couldn't see it. Yeah, be way too small. In fact, Earth would be this tiny grain of sand. So doing a scale model of the solar system is a big problem because the distances are huge and the sizes are small. So we're going to lay out the solar system so that everybody can see all the parts. And we're going to put the sun at just south of Monona Terrace on the bike trail there. Mm-hmm. And then continue out the bike trail, and at the scale distances of the planets from the sun, we're going to put markers indicating the distance and the size of the planets until we get to Pluto in Mount Horeb. Now,
that's a few miles.
Yeah, it's going to be about 23 miles is what it works out to be. So if the scale distance is 23 miles from the sun to Pluto, then the sun works out to be about 22 feet in diameter. So we'll lay out something on the ground there about that size. Mm-hmm. You get out to Earth. Earth's about the size of your fist, so easy to see. Pluto, though, is pretty small. It's about the size of a marble out there.
Need a sign there.
Yeah, yeah. So imagine looking for a marble when you're standing in there at Monona Terrace. I mean, it's amazing that Clyde Tombaugh ever found that thing.
So when will that happen?
Well, we don't have an exact schedule. We are planning to try to get up the markers along the bike path sometime in April. And try to leave it up there all summer, preferably till September. We're hoping that during the season, during the summer recreational season, that people will be able to take a stroll through the solar system, as much of it as they would like.
A bike ride.
If you want to do the whole thing, you're probably going to do a bike ride. Yeah. Uranus and Neptune are pretty far out there.
Well, we're going to do that.
So that should be fun. Most of the inner solar system is actually right around the downtown and campus area. You can easily walk out to Jupiter in about, 20 minutes, half an hour, depending on how fast you walk.
Okay. Gene in Ashland has a question or comment. Gene, hello to you.
Hello. On shortwave radio, I hear people who are interested in ham radio. They're talking about that they're looking for indications, I guess, that we have passed from sun cycle 23 into sun cycle 24. And I guess it means something to their propagations of radio communications. What are they talking about?
Oh, good. That's a really good question. I'm a ham radio operator. I'm looking for that solar cycle to come back, to come back too. the solar cycle is typically measured by what they call solar activity, which in its simplest form is just sunspots, which Galileo discovered in 1609. The number of sunspots on the sun is an indication of how active it is, but there's other stuff going on there too. Probably things like the amount of ultraviolet radiation that we get from the sun goes up and down with the sunspot cycle, and that in turn changes how much ionization there is up high in the Earth's atmosphere. And ionization means that some electrons are freed from atoms that are in the Earth's atmosphere. That makes that layer somewhat electrically charged, and it'll reflect radio waves. So what ham radio operators who want to communicate around the world do, normally radio waves without the ionosphere would just pass straight out into space.
Mm-hmm.
But at the ham radio, in the ham radio bands that are used for that kind of communication, the radio waves will bounce off of this ionosphere, this electrically conducting layer, and come back down to Earth, and that's called a skip. When it goes from the transmitter up to the ionosphere and then back down to the surface. So you can cover much longer distances than you could ordinarily, and actually multiple skips are possible. It'll bounce off the ocean, back up to the ionosphere, back down to the surface again. So we ham radio operators are eager for the solar activity to pick up, because then we'll be able to start talking to Europe and Africa and Asia once again with our ham radio sets at home. But right now the bands are really bad because solar activity is low. So that's what they're talking about.
Talking astronomy and optics today with Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, and Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Astronomy, the topic today with our two guests, Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place, Tom Hall of Eagle Optics. So if you have an optics question or question about astronomy, I hope you'll join us. The number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Lynn in Winneconne next. Lynn, hello.
Hi, hello, and good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I was wondering if your guests have a recommendation for, like, an email alert or a service that alerts people to things that are going on in the heavens, if for those of us who just don't sit around and study that all the time. I used to get a service called Skywatch, a gentleman in Israel, and it was free, I think, and it was just wonderful. I think he passed away. I do get NASA. It doesn't seem too complete, and I'm also wondering if there's a local angle to it, if there's somebody who would do that locally, and I'll take the answers off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling. Well, let's start with Jim.
I don't know of anybody who does that locally, but and I'm not sure what you mean by NASA, but I was going to recommend a website called spaceweather.com, which is effectively NASA, although it doesn't have NASA in the name there. Spaceweather.com is a really good place to go. It's where I go to look for alerts on various things. For example, solar activity, which is something that pops up with very little warning. But also, they'll always have something on there if there's a meteor shower coming up, or you can find out whether there's going to be an aurora borealis, again related to solar activity, from there. So that would be my first suggestion. Also, Sky and Telescope has an email alert thing that you can sign up for if you go to their website, which is, I'm pretty sure, still skyandtelescope, all one word, .com.
Mm-hmm.
You can sign up for their, I think, astro alerts, they call them, and I get those from time to time. There's at least one service that you have to pay for that will actually ring your telephone if there's, for example, an aurora borealis, and I think you can find that at spaceweather.com. I don't do that, but spaceweather.com, I think, is there too.
Tom, anything else?
There's another great website, space.com. I know they have a monthly calendar that may have an alerts section. I'm not sure they'll go direct to email, but I love their calendar section. And that's an easy one to pull up, and obviously deals with all things space, but they have one section in particular for monthly astronomical events.
And what's that again? It's space?
Space.com.
Space.com. Really, well, that's easy enough to remember. Space.com. Raleigh in Oak Creek is up next. Raleigh, hello.
Good morning, Jim, Larry, and Tom.
Hi.
I hope you can answer this question. I hope it's up your alley. I was having a little family debate the other day about the surface temperature of man-made objects such as spacecraft traveling to the moon. On its journey, given that the sun is falling on half the spacecraft, and while it's in the sun and not behind the planets, and whether they need heating or air conditioning, and how is that handled, if you happen to know?
Yeah.
In fact, they do have to have heating, and they don't quite have air conditioning exactly, but they have to have cooling in some cases. Right. The temperature extremes are enormous. So if you have a spacecraft out there with the sun shining on it, then the side facing the sun will have a very high temperature, and the side facing away from the sun will have a very low temperature. So you could have a few hundred degrees temperature difference from one side of the spacecraft to the other. And spacecraft are designed with heaters in there to try and keep the innards of the spacecraft, the instruments and the electronics and things like that, to try and moderate the temperature extremes, because those would be really hard on instruments of various sorts. So heating and usually radiative heat control is what they do on the side where you have to radiate some heat, or in the situations where you have to radiate some heat. They're designed specifically so that they're little radiator systems that allow the heat to escape back into space. So thermal control is a very big deal. Spacecraft designers have to deal with something called a thermal budget, which is how much energy you're going to be getting, how much are you getting from the sun, how much are you generating internally, what's that going to do to your temperatures, how do you control that? So that's a big issue.
Interesting.
Does that help?
Yes. Also, I was curious about the Earth and whether some of the heat that we have here on the planet Earth actually is coming from within the Earth and not just from the sun. Is that the case, too?
Some is. I don't know. I have no idea what the actual fraction. I'd have to guess that it's minimal compared to the energy input from the sun. In the case of the Earth, of course, we have the atmosphere spreading the heat around. So that's why we don't have the temperature extreme. Same thing happens on, say, Mercury. The side facing the sun is really hot, and the side facing away from the sun is really cold because no atmosphere to spread the energy around.
I think the Earth's average temperature, the average is something like 56 degrees. And that's where I was kind of extrapolating, well, a spacecraft's average temperature should be right about that, too, if it's flying near Earth.
I don't know what the average of the spacecraft is. That's a good question. I don't know.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Tom, Paul in Mosinee wonders if it's possible to see details on the space station through a backyard telescope. Can you do that, Tom?
It needs to be a fairly large scope.
Depends on what you mean by details.
Yeah.
You want to read the print on the...
at 12 inches or so of light gathering diameter, you can generally catch the solar panel structure. It shows some structure and shape, but you need a pretty excellent telescope, and you need perfect seeing, because generally you're punching through some pretty rough atmosphere to try to catch those details. But there's some nice amateur imaging of the station itself as it passes overhead. But, boy, it's pretty hard to catch in a 3-inch, 6-inch, that size telescope. Although in a 6-inch, you'll see that it's not a... one bright dot. You see some hints of, well, there's wings and structure. go try it. Go do it. That's the thing. You might be surprised at what you can pick up.
And somebody wondering, what are the 100 hours of astronomy?
Ah, yes. That's another one of these International Year of Astronomy events. And I should mention that we have a special page on the Space Place webpage, spaceplace.org, where we're attempting to put up links to other programs and, of course, details on what we're doing. 100 Hours of Astronomy is going to be a worldwide event from April 2nd through the 5th. And the detailed planning is left up to each club or community or whatever of what astronomical activities to have during the 100 Hours of Astronomy. And we're planning some activities ourselves. Space Place, that is planning some activities. And so I urge you to check back on the our website in the next few weeks as we get plans firmed up. What we hope to do is have astronomical viewing activities at a number of places around the city, and to have some events at Space Place. And they'll tie in with the science expeditions, which will be on April 4th. That's going to be on campus. We're going to do some astronomy activities there as well. So that should be a really great, well, it's not quite a weekend. It's 100 hours for roughly from the 2nd through the 5th of April. I think that's a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Very cool. Pete in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Larry. You mentioned earlier was the fact that the latest sunrise and the earliest sunset are actually about 3 weeks apart or so. My question is related to that, and that is that we know that on December 21, the sun is the lowest in the sky of any day of the year at noon on that day. But because I've been watching where the sun breaks the horizon behind a hill about 3 miles from our house, it's not so clear that the point of first sunrise at the horizon starts to move north on December 21st, and, you know, it would be moving slow at that point, or from the first few days after December 21st. But I get the impression it's several days later that the point of sunrise starts to move north. Can you help me sort that out?
I think it's actually several weeks later, and that mostly has to do with the inclination of the Earth's axis, that you don't quite drive the southernmost point until a few weeks after the equinox. Boy, and I can't remember the details of... I just read that a few weeks ago myself, but it's another odd effect of our tilt in the orbit and the fact that, you know, the orbit isn't exactly circular. All of those things are...
Yeah, well, and as the sun approaches the Tropic of Capricorn, it's when it touches, in effect, the Tropic of Capricorn, that's the winter solstice there. But it... it's kind of, if you were to think, it's kind of just tangent to it at that point. It's doing a low dip along the tropic. And so it's spending a lot of time moving almost parallel to the tropic at that time. So the north-south motion isn't very much. It's very little. So depending on how carefully you're actually measuring it, you may not see see much motion there for, quite some time. It could be, trying to think if it could be complicated by the local horizon as well. But at any rate, that north-south motion is very little right around the time of the solstice. So I can imagine it could be a while before you notice it.
But given that the latest sunrise is some 10 days after solstice, it might then be possible that that's the point at which the sun starts moving north at first daylight as well?
Well, no, I mean, it starts moving north after its maximum southward extension, which is on the day of the solstice.
Okay,
it's moving north.
We can't really see it.
That's right, but the daily progress is really small and picks up and is a maximum around the equinoxes. That's when the north-south change maximizes.
Right.
So if you look, at the horizon when the sun's rising roughly due east, then you're going to see, relatively speaking, a big change from day to day.
Right. And the fact that it took almost 10 days to really be sure it was moving north was more just an experimental error than actually that point of first contact moving. It was just that I couldn't detect it. Really.
That would be my guess. Yeah. I mean, again, it depends on how accurately you're looking there. But if you're just sort of going out and comparing it to landscape features, then that's what I would think is what is going on.
Okay, the point is 3 miles away, but it's still such a small movement. I think it probably was more just a sampling error, shall we say.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, observational error, right?
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Kelly emailed us from Duluth, and she says a guest was asking about resources. We have an amazing astronomer, photographer here in Duluth, Minnesota, named Bob King. And you could go to their website, DuluthNewsTribune.com, and then there's some more /pages/AstroBob. But I'm sure just go to the Duluth News Tribune, you'll be able to find it. He writes a blog through the Duluth News Tribune called AstroBob and keeps us all up to date on the daily events. Because of him, I was able to view an Iridium satellite the other night, which happened to be on my birthday. So there you have it. So
cool.
That's certainly worth a look.
It's a good tip.
Robert of Stevens Point wonders about the idea that space is infinite. He is challenged to grasp this idea and wonders if in 20 seconds, if you can explain the idea.
No. Well, I mean, it's an open question whether space, in fact, is infinite. I mean, that's something that cosmologists seriously consider, and whether they can visualize it or not, I don't know. But that's a question: is it infinite or is it finite? And there are models that work both ways. There are some cosmological models that suggest that the universe ought to extend without any sort of limit, and there are others that suggest that it is bounded. In either case, it's hard to imagine this because we're talking about models that involve more than the spatial dimensions that we're used to dealing with. And so we can't just extend our sort of three-dimensional, our kind of primate view of how the world works. We can't just extend that in three dimensions forever and expect that to correspond with the structure of space overall. So I know that's not a very satisfying answer, but it's not even clear that it is infinite. So the universe could be bounded.
Any place to go for a discussion on this, web or Snowflake? Think about that.
Yeah, let me think about that. Maybe I can find something here.
Richard in Marshfield, we turn to you next. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I wonder if your guests have ever heard of a program for called Celestia. It's a computer program that lets you fly around the universe, basically.
Yes, I have used Celestia, and you're right. It's quite good. In fact, its best property is, as you know, is that it's free.
Yeah.
You can download it from, if you Google for Celestia, I'm sure it'll pop up, and it's available, I think, on all the common platforms. I run it in Linux, and it's available for Windows and Macs. So, it's a fine program. It's, you're right. You get to pilot your own little virtual spaceship through the solar system.
Yeah. Wow. It's for me, a great way to get that idea of how big things are. 'Cause you can say, fly to Jupiter while you're looking at the Earth, and you can just watch the Earth go from this big, huge ball down to just a tiny little pinprick.
Yeah. You just look out the rear windshield there and watch Earth dwindle down to, it's pretty
cool. That sounds like a lot of fun.
It is cool.
Oh, yeah, and another thing is the other person was asking about the ISS. You can just type in the ISS, and it will zoom you right into Earth, and it will show you this little 3D model of the ISS station.
So what I hope is that people get excited by these software simulations and go look at the real sky.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm saying it's a little bit cold up there right now.
That's true.
Thanks, Richard.
I'm just checking around here real quick. One place to start, the Wikipedia has a really nice entry on physical cosmology. And typically those pages have good references as well. So that might be a place to start. And obviously the library, local library, and would be happy to help you find things about cosmology and things like whether space is infinite or not.
Josh in Brookfield, your turn. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Good. My question or comment has to do with the precession of the equinox. And I have done some reading and looking up onto this, and there's some different theories where the date is winter solstice of 2012. And some people say that it's the point at which we come to the center of the galaxy.
Oh, yeah.
And start moving back towards like the other end or something like that. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, usually then there's some mention of the Mayan calendar and a confluence of the planets and all that kind of stuff. As far as I know, that date is not special at all. And in fact, the coincidence of the precession of the equinoxes with the center of the galaxy, well, it doesn't happen. It does make sort of a closest approach. I don't remember the exact date of that. There's also not a, just because you'll find this out there if you start looking at this, there's not a confluence of the planets either in any significant sense. There's a couple of planets over there, but a couple of the big ones like Jupiter or something are not anywhere close, if I recall correctly. So that date has no particular significance, and there's no known interaction between the Earth and its orientation and the center of the galaxy, which is over towards Sagittarius. So I guess that would be my comment.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And Carl, I believe it is, Medford is up next. Hi.
Hi, Larry. This is Earl.
Oh, Earl. Sorry.
When we get these cold spells, I always think of Pluto. It comes to mind. And I wanted to say a few things in defense or on behalf of Pluto. It's got the largest moon relative to its size, I think, of any body in the solar system. Can almost be viewed as a double planet system, and I don't think it gets a lot of respect. Also, I want to know what your guests think about the New Horizons mission and what it might uncover there. I mean, we had a Voyager mission to Triton, Neptune's moon, which may be kind of a stand-in for Pluto, and saw fascinating things, even at very low temperatures, like ice geysers and the like.
Yeah. It should be very interesting to see what New Horizons finds out there, because nobody has ever seen a Kuiper object, which is what they call those, a Kuiper belt object, in its natural environment. We think we've seen them when comets occasionally come into the solar system, but then they're getting warm for the first time in their existence. So seeing one in its habitat, in this case Pluto, should be really interesting. The Pluto is one of the largest, of course, of the Kuiper belt objects, although not the largest, but it is the closest one, which is why New Horizons is headed there, and it is the only major object in the solar system that no space probe has investigated. So, right, we'll want to watch for that. I think 2015, is when it's
right.
supposed to fly by there. So that's definitely something to watch for.
And we've got something called Telescope Amnesty Days as well.
Yes, we've been doing, we've actually done these as Space Place for years. We used to call them telescope clinics, but the International Year of Astronomy term is Telescope Amnesty, so we've adopted that too. The idea is to encourage people to bring in. Tom was just helping me do one of those. We did one Saturday at Space Place, and we had, maybe 10
a nice
people,
collection.
People bring in their telescopes and say, how do I get this to work? And we help them set it up and take them out working. And people sometimes are interested in looking for acquiring a telescope, and we try to help talk about that. So that's a Telescope Amnesty Day. And we're going to have another one on February 20th, by the way. We will do a from 6 to 7 p.m. It'll be right before our normal sky program that night on that Friday. So February 20th will be the next one. And I hope to do, we normally have done two a year, but I'm thinking it's the International Year of Astronomy. We're going to try to add in some more. So again, watch our website, spaceplace.org, for notices about those.
And for that $10 to $15 range telescope.
The Galileo scope.
The Galileo scope, galileoscope.org.
That's right. Watch that website and they'll start taking orders, I'm hoping, sometime this week.
Guys, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
We'll have them back in this International Year of Astronomy to talk again. Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, faculty associate in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. Space Place, by the way, is located at 2300 South Park Street in the Villager Mall in Madison. And Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton. And if you want to see a range of optics, take a look at their website, eagleoptics.com, and you'll find a lot of good information there as well. So really pleased to have these guys with us, and they will be back. I can tell you that for sure. Well, next, we're going to take a look at eagles, and we're going to celebrate bald eagles here in Wisconsin with a couple of guests, Jeb Barzin and Randy Jurowitz, coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.